The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. It's hard to believe we're already at Friday. These weeks just keep going by faster and faster. I know we've got quite a few dancers in their regional competition there in the southeast United States. So we're anxious to get some news back from them perhaps next week on how everyone did. It's great to see the work always expanding and growing. Just thinking about the beautiful facilities that we have here at Edstone and the new structures that have gone up for the dance and the music program back at the headquarters campus, to see the growth and the expansion of this work, even with just a small group of faithful supporters, listeners like you, who are so excited to hear what comes out of God's headquarters in Edmond, Oklahoma, and to hear what comes out of KPCG, the church radio station, and of course the trumpet.com as well. On today's show, I've got a fair bit of news items to get through here in the first segment, having to do with mostly with Europe again. Here again, it's sounding like a broken record, I know, but the recent U.S. election, the impact that it's having on Europe, particularly the militarization of Europe. And then later on in this segment, too, we'll look at the big news in the States yesterday, Donald Trump intervening to save, quote-unquote, Carrier from moving those jobs down to Mexico. We'll have some sound bites from his speech yesterday after that deal was announced to keep some of those jobs in Indianapolis. In the second segment, we'll get into a short Bible study, basically taking a point out of one of the lectures I gave this morning, actually, in Epistles of Paul, that I think ties in with just some of the news items that we'll get to here in a moment. That if we have time, a little bit later in the program, we'll try to get through a few more emails. And if you'd like to email the program, don't hesitate to send your comments to td@kpcg.fm. Well, yesterday I referred to that New York Times piece about the EU building up its army, or significantly increasing its planned budget for an EU army. And GermanForeignPolicy.com, they're basically emailing a piece, it seems now every week, that really is eye-opening. The title of their email alert was Shock as Opportunity. I think they sent that out maybe Wednesday or perhaps yesterday. But it says here, thanks to Donald Trump's electoral victory, Berlin sees its opportunities for pushing for the creation of EU military structures and possibly European nuclear armed forces growing. I love the way the GermanForeignPolicy.com always describes Germany's involvement. It's never as if they're sort of a reluctant participant or that's working from the background, but rather that they see this as an opportunity to move forward. They see the Trump shock as an opportunity to build up a European military, a military, of course, that Germany would control, that Germany would dominate. It says here, Wolfgang Ischinger, the influential diplomat and chairman of the Munich Security Conference, is hoping that the Trump shock has dramatically increased the willingness to militarize the European Union. Last week, the European Parliament adopted a resolution that includes setting up the EU operational headquarters. We mentioned that on this program. establishing a political leadership for EU military operations and raising the military budgets of all member states to at least 2% of their GDP. And we talked more about the budget on yesterday's program. It says EU High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security, Federica Mogherini, continues to promote the idea of an EU superpower. And then it says, this is kind of summarizing the entire article and what's happened in the last couple of weeks. It says here, leading politicians and commentators are beginning to pick up the idea previously launched by a number of experts of the EU developing its own nuclear military forces on the basis of French and British nuclear weapons. Well, now Britain's on the way out. It says, however, for this, the French and British arsenals would be insufficient, according to a suggestive article published in one of Germany's leading opinion-forming dailies. Where do you suppose they're going with this line of thinking? I mean, Britain's on the way out with its arsenal. So it's basically just France. And then if what they have there is insufficient, then what does that mean? Well, you can expect them to build their own nuclear umbrella. Or, as we've said so many times before on this program, to help themselves to the nuclear arsenal that's already there, that's already on their own soil. It says here later, with an eye on the numerous hardly controllable crises rocking the EU, Ischinger demands that Berlin's ultimate objective be to maintain the EU and prevent Europe's further disintegration. So these are the extreme measures that need to be taken to preserve the EU. There's all these crises every direction. And now the Trump shock added to it all. For this, the vigorous promotion of the militarization of the EU would be helpful along the lines of the old concept of distracting from internal crises with aggressions abroad. It says, according to Ischinger, EU countries must agree to a European defense union with tightly enmeshed armed forces and a consolidated procurement and armaments system. It says, in this way, a great deal of money could soon be saved and considerable supplementary combat power generated. And then later it quotes him as saying, Germany must insist on the EU becoming a global player in an insecure world. Germany's got to take the lead. Germany's got to take the lead. Germany's got to keep the Union together. Germany's got to get behind this militarization of Europe. And even when they don't come right out and say it, like GermanForeignPolicy.com does, the implication is always there in these publications, in these articles coming out of the German press. You see it more and more. I was thinking this morning as I was just going through this, what would Herbert Armstrong be saying? How, I mentioned the point about passion today in class, and just how much passion that we've got to bring to this work. My father makes the point in one of his booklets about the passion behind Satan's great false system, his Holy Roman Empire. And how so many have been so devoted to that satanic cause, even to the point of obsession. And my father makes the point in one of his booklets that if that's the level of passion and enthusiasm for a satanic system that, well, through history, hasn't shied away from persecuting the true church of God, the work of God, then shouldn't we, as members of God's church, as co-workers, as donors together, shouldn't we bring the passion and the zeal that we need in support of God's true church, in support of God's true work, the only work on this earth that's disseminating the truth? It's like I said yesterday. I mean, who else is out there crying aloud and sparing not, as it says in Isaiah 58? Who else is out there explaining these prophecies of God as they unfold before our eyes? It says here, Ischinger expressed the hope that through the Trump shock, willingness for the accelerated militarization of the EU could have could have dramatically grown. It says the West label could serve as the identifying feature of a future more combative EU. I mean, we're the West, in other words. The United States is going its own way. They're the ones that are veering off course. Notice this. It says, for my child's generation, this is quoting this Ischinger guy, this influential member of the German think tank. It says, for my children's generation, he said, it will not be possible to see U.S. President-elect Donald Trump as the embodiment of the Western set of values. We are the West now, declared Ischinger. We are the West. Berlin and the EU must now take on the responsibility for the ideas and values of the West. I mean, Donald Trump certainly isn't doing it. That's the way the thinking is in Europe. He's not upholding and promoting Western values. So much of what he believes and says, it flies right in the face of what we consider to be Western values. And so we're now the West. And we need to be a superpower, as Mogherini says. Or this Ischinger. We need to build an army, a unified army. We need to consolidate our forces. Where is this headed? You know where it's headed. Bible prophecy tells us where this is going. It says the EU's militarization campaign already initiated last summer and now merely legitimized and accelerated following Donald Trump's election is continuing. So it's just gaining momentum. I mean, it was initiated last summer. And along the way on this very program, we've been telling you, here's the plans, here's the white paper, here's what they're talking about, here's what they're still wrangling over, here's where they need funding, and so on and so forth. And now the Trump shock, I mean, it's really giving this movement to militarization all the momentum that it needs. It says here, finally, last week, the European Parliament provided new impetus to the EU's war policy. Well, it just goes and reviews some of the things that have been happening in recent weeks for Europe to embrace this strategic autonomy concept, as we quoted yesterday, a phrase that you keep seeing in these publications, in these papers, calling for Europe to be strong on defense. It says later here, while EU foreign policy chief Federica Mogherini enticingly makes reference to the EU as a superpower to bolster hegemonic ambitions aimed at establishing a tightly enmeshed EU armed forces, German politicians and commentators are beginning to envisage the establishments of EU nuclear forces. I mean, here's how this article concludes. We need a bigger budget. We need to come together. We need to consolidate. And also, we better start thinking about a nuclear umbrella. It says, following similar pleas advanced by German foreign policy experts, Roderick Kaiswetter, foreign policy spokesman of the CDU-CSU parliamentary group in the Bundestag, demanded that Berlin convince Paris and London to provide a nuclear umbrella for the EU. And again, it goes on and talks about how that they've talked about this before. They've even gone into the United States and pushed for this idea there. But now it appears to be catching on following Trump's electoral victory. It says the nuclear umbrella would be costly but could be financed through a joint European military budget due to begin in 2019. It says an editorial in a leading German... Notice how this concludes. An editorial in a leading German daily raises the question of European nuclear deterrence capacity, for which the French and British arsenals would be insufficient. The commentator, however, does not explain which country should lend a helping hand. So if it's insufficient with what the French have, well then which country should pitch in and contribute to this cause and help to build up this military, or rather this nuclear umbrella? GermanForeignPolicy.com says one could assume that he's not considering small EU members such as Luxembourg. No, it's not going to be Luxembourg. It's not going to be Luxembourg that takes the lead. in building up this nuclear umbrella. You know what GermanForeignPolicy.com is getting at. Germany is going to step up. Another piece here in the Wall Street Journal. This is according to Europol, the European Union Police Agency. Their warning of ISIS, because of some of the setbacks in Syria and Iraq, they're warning that ISIS may turn its attention more to softer targets in Europe, like we've seen happen previously in Nice, in Paris, in Germany. It says here that the Islamic State attackers have shifted focus to softer, more random targets in Europe instead of the police or military in an effort to intimidate the public. And so what happens if we've talked a lot in the last couple of weeks about the Trump shock? Well, what happens if there's another terrorist shock in Paris or in Berlin or in Munich or in Vienna? What happens if there's another big attack? I mean, it seems as if that's inevitable. Even most liberal commentators would assume that that's going to happen soon. But here's Europol, the police agency in Europe, warning of what's coming. It says the militant group retains the will and the capability to stage attacks in Europe in the near future, according to a report by Europol's European Counterterrorism Center. While attackers will continue to use guns, bombs, knives, and vehicles, terrorism techniques used in Syria and Iraq, such as car bombs, could also be imported to Europe, the report said. This is from the Wall Street Journal just today, a few hours ago. It says the EU faces threats from both networked groups and lone wolf attackers, and is prone to attacks that are carefully planned as well as those that appear spontaneous, according to the report. It says while Islamic State is the main group threatening Europe, well, the threats could come from other groups. It says finally the Europol report said all EU member states were at risk of the types of attacks that have occurred recently in France and Belgium. The report, echoing past statements by European officials, said as Islamic State is weakened in Syria and Iraq, there is the possibility that foreign fighters might try to enter the EU at a higher rate, posing a significant and long-term security challenge. And this comes at a time when the United States is turning inward and saying, Europe, you fend for yourself, and you know what the prophecy has to say in Daniel 11 and verse 40, how that the king of the south will push and push and push at the king of the north until finally the king of the north responds with a furious whirlwind type response. That's something we haven't even really talked about, terrorism in Europe, that often in the last few weeks. It's been somewhat quiet, quieter anyway. But what happens when you get the next attack, like we've seen even this year in Brussels, or last year in Paris, or this year in Nice? That's just going to throw fuel on this fire. It's already raging in Europe. It sure is. As to that transatlantic relationship, which we've been alluding to here, this Trump shock and the way Europe is responding, this article here from Real Clear World Real Clear World, is titled that the relationship, or it says in the title that the relationship really between Europe and the United States, it was already dying before Donald Trump ever came along. Says the election of the brash businessman has caused some to already declare the transatlantic relationship dead. Trump's lukewarm statements toward NATO, his radical anti-immigrant proposals, and his embrace of Russia will make it difficult for European leaders to embrace him. For many, the transatlantic community, the bedrock of global democracy, appears to be crumbling. But then it goes on to say, I mean, look at what was already happening before Trump came along. Look at the areas that divided the United States and Europe. Russian sanctions, the government data collection. I mean, sharp differences on all of surveillance, counterterrorism. and even President Obama himself wanting to pivot away from Europe and the Middle East to focus in on Asia. And even Obama himself saying that NATO needs to step up. The member states in NATO, they need to pull their weight. It says here, the transatlantic relationship, a term used to define the shared defense, economic, diplomatic, and cultural ties between the U.S. and the democracies of Europe, was born out of necessity. Listen to this history. I mean, this is history we have talked about, that order, the post-World War II order. And just be reminded here of how this relationship was established and why it was established in the first place. It was born out of necessity after the Second World War. The fragile states of Western Europe relied on the United States to help rebuild their shattered economies, to guard against communist pressure within their politics, and to defend against the potential Soviet invasions. And so you have this American umbrella that served to protect these nations, these Western nations. It says the United States, for its part, was paranoid of potential communist domination in Europe and relied on its European allies to offset the growth of Russian power among Eastern European nations. Although disagreements and tensions routinely surfaced during the Cold War, the common goal of defeating communism cemented the transatlantic alliance as the cornerstone of each side's foreign policy. Well, it says now, you know, we're 25 years on from the end of the Cold War. And it's causing many to call into question the necessity of this alliance. This alliance that's been there since the end of World War II. The article says here that Europe has transformed from a dependent of the United States to a primary competitor. Now put this together with everything else we've been reading and studying these last few months. And again, think about Herbert Armstrong and what he'd be saying today. It's no longer dependent on the U.S. Europe's a primary competitor. What is this leading to? It explains how that you know, we've had trouble. The United States has had trouble finding trade deals with Europe. They've wrangled over some of these details. It goes on and says, at the same time, the fall of the Soviet Union has drastically reduced the threat of direct military conflict in the continent. Well, I don't know about that anymore. But it says here, while Europe still must confront evolving security problems emerging from the Middle East, North Africa, and a more assertive Russia, these threats pale in comparison to those once posed by the Soviet Union. So you see what they're getting at. I mean, it was already on the down and out, this transatlantic alliance, because of all these other factors. And looking at it humanly, you can see why individuals like Barack Obama and Donald Trump have said, hey, it's an old archaic alliance, and we need to rethink this. The world is different in 2016 compared to 1946, and that's true. But keeping in mind what Bible prophecy informs us, I mean, it tells us there's one final resurrection to come out of Europe, and that's where we need to be looking. I mean, there's other prophecies, of course, that include Russia and China and the King of the South in the Middle East, and that talk about Ephraim and Manasseh, the United States and Britain. But the King of the North, the rising beast power, I mean, this prophecy, not just in one passage, it's spoken of in so many prophecies all throughout the Bible. That's where we have to keep our focus. It says, as the transatlantic alliance falls from its once dominant position, Europe and the United States will begin to pursue more divergent policies as they adapt to increasingly varied national interests. So they're heading in different directions. They're pursuing more divergent policies. And you see the United States now consumed with national interests. Yesterday, Donald Trump announced that he had, well, pretty much single-handedly saved Carrier, this outfit in Indiana that produces furnaces and air conditioners. Indiana, of course, is Mike Pence's home state. He's still serving as governor there until he moves into his new position as vice president. But the details now that are emerging about this so-called save is that the U.S. government, well, rather actually the state government in Indiana, is going to extend $7 million in tax breaks to United Technologies. That's the parent company of Carrier. United Technologies is a multi-billion dollar industry. I think last year it earned $7.5 billion, so it's one of America's more successful companies. And with this small branch, Carrier, in Indiana, as you may have seen in the news yesterday or all through the campaign, Donald Trump made it a pretty big point in a lot of his stump speeches, pointing to this this group, this business, moving its factory to Mexico and slashing 1,400 jobs or thereabouts. So now that we see the details coming in, these tax breaks, $7 million in tax breaks over the next 10 years, what that amounts to is that the taxpayers in Indiana will essentially be covering about $7,000 per job that remains in Indiana. So the taxpayers will end up paying for that, those jobs that stay. And there's other things that factored into the decision too, I'm sure. Like the threats that, and we had this program, a couple of weeks ago, about what Donald Trump thinks about the prospect of a trade war. He says, who cares? Who cares? We got to do what's right for the United States. All these deals, they're bad deals for us. NAFTA, it's like a one-way street out of the United States. There's nothing we get in return. And so he's here to fix it. And how's he going to fix it? Well, as we learned yesterday, through government subsidies and threats. Threats that if you move your factory to Mexico and then you want to sell your product back to the United States, you are going to pay a penalty. There will be consequences. And you think about the precedent that this sets for, I mean, what will other companies be thinking? What will other companies be thinking? And what kind of a burden could this put on U.S. taxpayers across the country if this is something that, as he said, Donald Trump said it yesterday in his speech, this self-congratulatory speech, that this was something he was going to be doing a lot of, calling these individual companies, offering them subsidies, threatening them with consequences if they choose to leave. Here's a bit from his speech announcing this deal with Carrier yesterday, clip one.
Companies are not going to leave the United States anymore without consequences. Not going to happen. It's not going to happen. I'll tell you right now. We're losing so much.
So they're not going to leave anymore, U.S. companies. It's a strong arm position to take. I mean, in the course of the speech, he talked about lowering taxes and removing regulations, and certainly, to provide companies with incentives to stay, to encourage them to stay, to even plead for them to stay, but to threaten them to stay, to threaten punishment. There have been quite a few stories, not as many as there should be, but quite a few that talk about how that this United Technologies also gets about $6 billion in defense contracts each year from the U.S. government. So this incoming administration, Donald Trump's incoming administration, it did have a fair bit of leverage here. For one, and just the bully pulpit alone. If they did move, he already made it a pretty significant point in his stump speeches. Now he's the president-elect. And him going after United Technologies or Carrier or maybe threatening to take away some of those defense contracts, or threaten, as he did openly throughout the campaign, to slap a 30-35% tariff on those products when they come back into the United States. Well, Carrier made the announcement, I think, back in February, and they already have the factory down in Mexico. They had pretty much built, and here's what Donald Trump had to say about that, clip two.
You know what Greg said? Greg said, but you know, the plant is almost built, right? I said, Greg, I don't care. It doesn't make any difference. Don't worry about it. What are we going to do with the plant? Rent it, sell it, knock it down. I don't care.
Knock it down, sell it, whatever. I don't care. Just keep the business in Indiana. This is setting the tone for how he intends to operate as President of the United States. Following the same playbook, really, that President Obama followed from the start, established from the start, using his pen, his phone, to get the job done. No matter what Congress thought, no matter what his critics thought, the precedent, I mean, it's already really been established before Donald Trump came along, but what's pretty amazing to watch is that those supporters of Mr. Trump that were so strong in their denunciations of President Obama when he did it, now they're cheering. They can't get enough of this. Well, he's saving jobs. He's saving jobs. It's so short-sighted. It's lacking in vision. How will nations respond? We went through this again in that show a couple weeks ago. How will nations abroad respond to this? How will businesses at home respond to these kinds of threats? And supposing there are subsidies to go around, I mean, how much more is going to be added to the national debt? I mean, in the end, isn't it the success of the company that determines whether those jobs are going to be saved, whether they move one factory to Mexico or not? And the reason those factories are moving, I'm sure a lot of it has to do with the heavy, heavy corporate taxes and the excessive regulations by the thousands. And to come along and want to reduce the size of government and to try to get out of the way, to try to get out of the way of the free market, yeah, that's one thing. But to use that office, to use his administration, to use the presidency to shake down companies, that's what the Wall Street Journal calls it. It's a dangerous new course that we're on. Here's another tidbit from yesterday's speech, clip three.
I always say great business people, they have flexibility. You know, if you're hardline, well, we're not going to move. Flexibility. That's why they've done so well over the years. That's why it's a great company, because they have flexibility. But we're not going to need so much flexibility for other companies, because we are going to have a situation where they're going to know, number one, we're going to treat them well, and number two, there will be consequences, meaning they'll be taxed very heavily at the border. If they want to leave, fire all their people, leave, make product in different companies, in different countries, and then think they're going to sell that product over the border.
He praised Carrier. He praised the leadership at United Technologies for being very flexible. It all came across as a reasonable discussion over the phone. And he said that, with other companies, we're not going to need to be so flexible, because they're going to know there will be consequences. That's the oncoming presidency of the United States. The Wall Street Journal, as I said, calls it a Carrier shakedown. The editorial board said this morning, a giant flaw in President Obama's economic policy has been the politicized allocation of capital from green energy to housing. Donald Trump suffers from a similar industrial policy temptation, as we've seen this week with his arm twisting of Carrier to change its decision to move a plant to Mexico from Indiana. people just need to dig a little bit beneath the surface. I mean, look, I'm an American. As American, of course you want jobs to stay in America. Of course you want to see a government add incentives for companies to keep their factories in America. You want to see those factories in the Rust Belt filled with workers. But look at the bigger picture of what's happening here. And in the end, how many jobs will this really save? In fact, it's going to cost more jobs. The Wall Street Journal says Carrier announced Wednesday that it will retain about 1,000 jobs in Indianapolis that would have moved to Mexico over the next 3 years. And on Thursday, Mr. Trump held a rally at the plant and claimed political credit. He says the president-elect had made Carrier a piñata for his trade politics during the campaign. Everyone, even at the Obama White House, is hailing the move as a great political victory. And in the short term, it is for those Indianapolis workers. In the short term, it's a victory for those workers, okay? But what about the long term? And what about the bigger picture? The Journal says, as the U.S. auto workers have learned the hard way, real job security depends on the profitability of the business. Carrier wanted to move the production line to Mexico to stay competitive in the market for gas furnaces. If the extra costs of staying in Indianapolis erode that business, those workers will lose their jobs eventually in any case. It goes on to say the impossible position that Donald Trump put Mr. Hayes in, the head of that company. It says this isn't to fault Mr. Hayes' decision, since Mr. Trump made him an offer he couldn't refuse. The state of Indiana threw in $7 million in tax incentives, but those weren't decisive. Mr. Trump's real hammer is his threat to impose a tariff on Carrier imports to the U.S. Carrier has a 30% share of the U.S. gas furnace market, and a 35% tariff could kill the business. That's the same sword Mr. Trump previously held over Ford Motor Company. And here again, you see all these supposed conservative sites celebrating these moves. Moves that 8 years ago they would have been denouncing. Who does this individual think he is, they would have said 8 years ago, to hold a sword over these companies? It says, finally, United Technologies also gets about 10% of its revenue from sales to the Pentagon, another source of government leverage. Then there's the potential damage to the Carrier brand, especially its consumer air conditioner sales. If Mr. Trump decided to blast it from the bully, and we mean bully, pulpit. So, United Technologies decided to take the small cost against earnings and invest to make the Indiana plant more competitive. Well, there's lots of celebrations among Republicans and the Donald Trump camp right now today. But let's look at this a little bit later down the road and see what ultimately happens. Well, this article even leaves out the impact that this could have on relations with other nations, because as I brought out in that program a couple weeks back, what are other nations thinking? Okay, they see Donald Trump with all these protectionist measures now. We're going to keep these jobs here. Companies, we're going to be inflexible. They're going to stay home because they're going to know there's going to be consequences. And as for those countries abroad, they're going to know that we're not going to be cheated or ripped off anymore. And so as he rips up all of these trade agreements, as he imposes all of these tariffs, we'll wait and see the inevitable trade war that this will cause. It's pretty amazing to watch all these things happening simultaneously. One final clip here from his comments yesterday, this is clip 4.
We're going to be doing this, and if I have to tell you, during speeches, I'd say, they say it's not presidential to call up these massive leaders of business. I think it's very presidential. And if it's not presidential, that's okay. That's okay, because I actually like doing it. But we're going to have a lot of great people that can also do it and do it as well as I do it. But we're going to have a lot of phone calls made to companies when they say they're thinking about leaving this country because they're not leaving this country. They're not going to leave this country. And the workers are going to keep their jobs. And they can leave from state to state. And they can negotiate good deals with the different states and all of that. But leaving the country is going to be very, very difficult.
They can go state to state. They're not going to be able to leave the country. These are the rules. These are the parameters the President of the United States is laying down for companies in America. And he said there at the start, I mean, some have said it's not presidential, and if it's not, that's okay. I like doing this. And this is just the way I operate. I'm a businessman. This is the art of the deal. And you have to ask, I mean, is it presidential? I mean, is this what a president's responsible for? Is this what the framers had in mind when they drew up the Constitution? That the president in the White House would strong-arm his way to keep companies in the United States? It's incredible, really. I mean, you talk about a dangerous, dangerous precedent. And you talk about just a lack of vision. And there's quite a lot of pride here and vanity that, well, we have the experience. We have the know-how. We have the solutions. We're going to save these jobs. We're going to make America great again. As I'll cover, if I have enough time here, in the next segment, it's dangerous to think that way, given what God says in Jeremiah 17. That's not presidential. I don't care. That's what I like to do. They're not leaving this country. They're not leaving. That's Donald Trump regarding Carrier and any others. They're going to be making lots and lots of phone calls. One final piece here from the National Review. This is about the infrastructure boondoggle, as it's called in this title. Donald Trump's administration wanting to spend $1 trillion. $1 trillion on infrastructure. So we're right where we were 8 years ago. All of this money going into so-called infrastructure projects, and we're at the same point. It says here, Stephen Moore, a Trump economic advisor and a man I know and respect, this is at National Review, recently told congressional Republicans that since Donald Trump won the election, it's their duty to deliver on his agenda, even if his policies are bad ideas. The review says, no, bad ideas are bad ideas, even when voters choose them. Otherwise, we all should have gone along with every bad idea that President Obama proposed over the last 8 years. Moore is talking in particular about Trump's plan to spend $1 trillion on or more on infrastructure projects. It says, like many of Trump's ideas, the infrastructure proposal is less an actual plan than a vague notion. As Trump's chief strategist, Steve Bannon, put it, we're just going to throw it up against the wall and see if it sticks. Harkening back to FDR, Bannon calls Trump's plans as exciting as the 1930s. That's his chief advisor. This is the 1930s all over again. As if he's unaware of what happened at the end of that decade. All of those protectionist measures, all of that government spending. This is his advisor, this is his economic advisor in the case of Stephen Moore. Well, he got elected. He won the presidency, and we've got to give him what he wants. It says, supporters of an infrastructure program at a time of almost $20 trillion in national debt justify it on two grounds. First, they correctly note that the federal government can currently borrow relatively cheaply with interest rates so low, primarily because other investment options like the euro are such bad bets. The U.S. may be deep in debt, but we are still the fastest horse in the glue factory. That's the way they reason. Well, we have a lot of debt, but look, we still are the United States. And interest rates are so low, we might as well borrow. We might as well throw $1 trillion into the economy. I mean, after all, we're gonna get a lot of jobs from that. There's going to be a lot of people getting jobs from this. It says here, and yet even with low rates, we still pay $284 billion in interest payments. That's in 2016. $284 billion this year that contributes nothing to the economic growth of our country. It's just paying interest on the debt. And that debt cost is going to go up. Without question, it's going to skyrocket. With this kind of thinking, this thinking that's no different from the previous administration. It's just like a drug in Washington, D.C. I think my father said it like that before. They're hooked on deficit spending. The more, the better. The more we can run up the debt, the better it will be for our economy. The better it will be for our future. That's the thinking. And it's so far removed from the truth of your Bible. And it's breaking the back of the United States. That's the truth. It's robbing our future generations. Well, we're not even going to be around that long to wonder how it impacts our children. Because it's going to break our back, and soon. Already, it's like an albatross. Already it's that way. And yet here you have leaders coming in from the so-called conservative wing, and they're out there saying, you know what we need to do now? We need to spend $1 trillion more. We need to borrow our way out of this. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. When we come back, we'll get into that section of scripture that I mentioned a bit ago, Jeremiah chapter 17. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
We finished up with 2 Corinthians 10 today in Epistles of Paul, where Paul talked about bringing our thoughts, every thought, into captivity to the obedience of Christ. As I was telling the students, we've got to see that the battlefield that we're on and the war that we wage, it's within our minds. That's where we face those major battles and even those minor skirmishes every single day. The fight goes on in between our ears. And God says through the Apostle Paul in that verse, 2 Corinthians 10:5, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God. Every high thing, every vain imagination, everything that would exalt itself against God. We've got to bring our thoughts into the captivity of Christ, to the obedience of Christ. How many traditional Christian religions or denominations would hold up this verse as a memory verse, like we do at God's College, the obedience of Christ? Well, they don't want to talk about obedience. They don't want to talk about God reproducing his own character in us. So many of them just want to talk about lawlessness. Like it says in Jude 4, they want to turn the grace of God into lasciviousness or lawlessness. The Bible has a lot to say about the human heart, the heart that doesn't have every thought brought into the captivity to the obedience of Christ. Romans 8:7 says that it's hostile to the law of God, that nature, that carnal mind. And then here in Jeremiah 17, it says that the carnal mind is deceptive and that it will do anything possible to get around doing what God says to do, to get around the basic principles of the Bible, the basic truths about economy and finance and leadership and business and industry. The carnal mind will reason around it, will excuse evil behavior, justify sin, and convince us all the same that, well, what we're doing is perfectly reasonable. It makes sense. I mean, after all, look at the bottom line. Look at the people. Look at the 1,000 families that this helps. Look at how many jobs we could add if we borrowed this much money. Jeremiah 17:5 says, "Thus says the Eternal, cursed be the man that trusts in man and makes flesh his arm and whose heart departs from the Eternal." That's the curse that mankind's been under for 6,000 years. And it's because we've placed our faith in men. Flesh is our arm of strength. Flesh is what we rely upon. Flesh is what we look to. And so if he comes along with these kinds of ideas that are going to run up the debt, or that are going to eliminate jobs in the long run, or that are going to add tax payments to people paying taxes, well, it's bad. It's evil if it's the other party. And if it's our party, well, it's good. It's great. Never mind what God says, or making God our strength. It says in verse 6, the Living Bible says, "He's like a stunted shrub in a desert with no hope for the future." Individuals that put their trust in men, that is. They're just like a shrub in the wilderness, in the desert. No life there. No fruit. Nothing. No produce. Just a fruitless existence. And yet it says in verse 7, "Blessed is the man that trusts in God, and whose hope the Lord is, for he shall be a tree planted by the waters, and that spreads out her roots by the river, and shall not see when the heat comes. But her leaf shall be green, and shall not be careful in the year of drought, neither shall cease from yielding fruit." God wants us to be a beautiful fruit-producing tree. And the only way that can happen is if we put our faith, our trust in him and him alone. It says in verse 9 that the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? Who can know the human heart? It's so evil. It's so wicked. It's so deceitful. There's a sickness there, an incurable sickness in the heart of man. And that's what we want to put our trust in? Look at our system of education and how that it views the human heart, basically saying that human nature is basically good and trustworthy. And then the blindness that sets in, like you see on this video that was circulating the other day, all these college students that were saying Fidel Castro, they had more respect and admiration for him than they did for Donald Trump. These Americans, these young Americans that have grown up in these educational institutions where they've just been brainwashed. Trump certainly has some flaws, but to think about that godless communist society, boy, all of these examples, it just highlights how desperately we need the government of God on this earth. Look at the sickness. And look at how it's spreading. How are we going to know Who can know it, it says in verse 9. Deceitful above all things. Well, God can help us. He can help us to know. He can help us to see where we get off on our thinking, where we're not bringing our thoughts into the captivity of the obedience of Christ. Jeremiah 17:10 says, I, the Lord, search the heart. I try the reins, even to give every man according to his ways and according to the fruit of his doings. See, God can show us. He shows us in his inspired word the way to go. And if we trust him in faith, and if we go along according to that way, we're going to be like that fruitful vine, that tree planted by the waters, as it says in verse 7, that spreads out her roots by the river, and that's just going to go right on producing, even when the heat sets in, because there's such a deep root system, because it's so grounded. Verse 14 says, heal me, O Lord, and I shall be healed. Save me, and I shall be saved, for you are my praise. See, if we can get off our high horse and humble ourselves before God and come to see that we need healing and that God can heal the heart of man, he'll do it. He'll do it, and then we can begin the process of bringing every thought into the captivity and of the obedience of Jesus Christ. That's going to take, as I said in class this morning, a real courageous, warrior-like spirit. We've got to fight and fight every day and not be satisfied with a few small victories. We've got to go for the big victories in our fight against sin, in our fight against our adversary. Well, that brings us to the conclusion of yet another program here on KPCG.FM. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Every day, 7 a.m. in Oklahoma, 1 p.m. here in the U.K. You can listen to our live broadcast. Email the show, td@kpcg.fm. Thanks for joining us. See you next week.